Welcome to This Week in Private Markets, a podcast by TAP. We give investors, allocators, advisors, and others a weekly digest that keeps you in the know about the news in private markets. Please see the show notes for relevant disclaimers. This is the week of October 2nd, and this is what we at TAP saw in private markets. We'll start, as always, with the big deals of the week. Brookfield raised $12 billion for its flagship private equity fund. Bain Capital raised 6.35 billion euros for its European Fund VI, which has about 26% more commitments than its predecessor vehicle. The European venture capital firm Atomico raised $1.1 billion in defiance of the tech slowdown. And finally, Greylock closed a new $1 billion fund to invest in early stage startups. And with that, let's get into the top stories of the week. We start with a stark warning from Moody's, which says that there are systemic risks in private equity and private credit, right? So as we've talked about on the show numerous times, private credit, private lending is growing like crazy. And on top of that, a lot of these firms are increasingly sourcing capital from individual investors, from high net worth individuals. And Moody's is suggesting all of this snowballing into a rapidly growing, interrelated lending, investing loop that, if push comes to shove, could be systemically dangerous. What do we think?
Well, yeah, I think there's a couple trends here that are interesting. I mean, usually I don't take too seriously anything the credit rating agencies say, to be honest. But I think this is actually pretty thoughtful and something to call out. We've talked on this podcast quite a bit about the growth of private credit generally. You know, it's trillions and trillions of dollars now, approaching somewhat to rival, you know, the syndicated loan market and you know, junk bond market or high yield bond market rather. So that's been a trend for the last decade, that growth. And, you know, perhaps now it's growing faster due to the fact that other pockets of capital like family offices and high net worth individuals are being tapped to help fuel the growth of that. But I think the second trend is, you know, more interesting and that it's actually, while there's been a lot of growth in private credit, it seems like a lot of these, there's been also a lot of consolidation kind of in direct lending. So a lot of direct lenders becoming parts of, you know, more traditional private equity entities. For example, Apollo has its direct lending unit, obviously also world famous for its traditional buyout kind of business. When you start seeing these direct lenders paired with private equity, I guess the argument is, you know, if these direct lenders start to, you know, experience severe problems, does it bring down the private equity side of the house and then have a, you know, very disruptive impact on, you know, all of these kind of lower market and middle market businesses in the United States, which make up, you know, I think at least a third of the economy. Do they start to face, risk from their sort of private equity owners going under potentially? I don't know if we know enough yet to understand the pockets of risk developing, but it's certainly an interesting thing to point out. And I think it's a clever thing to point out.
It's huge. And there's definitely risks in it that I think they're just calling out that we should be on the lookout for. I don't think there was anything particularly incendiary about what Moody's was saying or over the top. It does make sense when you have something that's grown from, you know, 500 billion to 1.2 trillion to start adding more insight into it. That doesn't mean limitations or anything. And I think, you know, really where you get what systemic risk is this sort of contagion risk. It's the risk of something that hits the system. And in this case, we talked last week about how private equity firms are probably systemically important if they were to go under as a whole. Like, most likely they are already implicitly systemically important, although no one said this word perhaps until we're talking about it here on this program, but they probably are if they were to go under. Now, the assumption is that there's all this segregation between all the assets in their business, that they're not using leverage. But what Adam's talking about here is that, well, once you kind of start to have the private equity side of the house and the lending side of the house, and they're all inside of there, does there start to become too much like commingling? And there's sort of this contagion effect within that could cause, let's say, something like a Blackstone to just fall apart, you know? And I don't know. I don't see it yet, but I think it is worth keeping an eye on. I just don't see, I haven't really thought too much about the dynamics of how that would go down, but I don't see like there being some sort of internal issue with that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see. I mean, I think the danger when you kind of lump on a, you know, direct lending business that's extending out billions and billions of dollars of loans is, I mean, you're multiplying your counterparty risk in an area of, you know, the financial markets or the financing markets that's not, you know, very transparent and obviously not regulated. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not really counterparty risk though. If you own them, it's not counterparty risk. It's actually the reverse,
well,
you know.
Well, I guess I'm saying if your loans start to go bad, and that starts to mess up, you know, the larger private equity enterprise. You know, the
I feel like it's got to be the reverse, right? You know, if all the companies start to go bad, then you start to have issues with the loans. I mean, I guess it could go, the arrow could point both directions, but
yeah, I guess all I'm saying is that, you know, typical buyout historically was more likely to be funded by, you know, different types of financing structures that right. were more regulated, that, you know, people could actually go and trade those loans or bonds. You know, this is a bit of a shadow banking type industry that now is increasingly involved in buyouts and increasingly, you know, could perhaps bring down private equity managers that provide, you know, operational and financial support to many companies that perhaps have nothing to do with these loans that have been issued by the other side of the house. That's all I think right now. It's hard to really know, but you know, for once you see a credit rating agency actually saying something you know, pretty intelligent. So we'll see how this
they only get famous for their failures. So
right, exactly.
They probably put out these reports all the time, and then, you know, the one time that when they do mess up and something goes wrong, they get forever infamous for that that screw up.
Good stuff. Let's move on to the next story here. The private equity giant Carlyle is moving away from certain segments of its U.S. buyouts business, in particular the consumer, media, and retail sectors. Apparently have too many headwinds for them, so they're leaving those entirely, but they are continuing to focus on financial services, tech, healthcare, industrials, and government services.
Are they really, though? Are they actually pulling away from consumer, or is it just that they wanted to fire the team that was running this business? Because if they're, you know, I don't know, it doesn't make as much sense that they'd really want to pull away from literally these huge sectors in the economy completely. I know that they've, you know, they've got a new CEO that came in February that is looking to sort of tighten it up, and is probably looking to make cuts. I know that this group had some investments. I think that the performance wasn't so great, is what it sounded like. And so, you know, they let go of that team. I don't know. Maybe it's just a cover for, you know, this sort of like sector focused thing. It's just a cover for, you know, that they let go of a team and, you know, are reducing headcount generally.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they would have rehired, you know, or replaced some of the team members instead of disbanding the whole team wholesale. I will say, I mean, Carlyle's made some horrible consumer retail investments, you know, Supreme, I think, you know, being one of them. I don't know, maybe because they're based in DC, they, you know, they want to be more culturally relevant. They made these big bets on, you know, streetwear brands like Supreme, that proved to be quite unwise. I mean, I will say, you know, I think consumer retail is a very hard sector to make a lot of money in. You know, there's a handful of really great bets. I mean, I don't know, North Face, for example, might be one of them, Lululemon. I mean, there are certain success stories, but generally speaking, this is not an industry that private equity has been able to turn around in the face of all of these sort of, you know, changes in how we consume and how we consume retail products and apparel and everything else. And it has just been a notoriously difficult place to make money. And that's why, frankly, you've seen an insane amount of, you know, consumer and retail bankruptcies over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. So, you know, it's possible that, you know, they understand that this is just not really a place for them to focus. I would also note, you know, that this is, you know, Carlyle perhaps, you know, is having the most trouble among the kind of, you know, top name private equity managers in actually raising for their flagship fund. They only reached, I think, 2/3 of their $22 billion target. I've not seen, you know, that sort of poor of a performance among, you know, Apollo, you know, Blackstone, KKR, sort of a lot of its peers. So it's possible the team at Carlyle is really just facing a lot of pressure at this point to cut costs and rationalize the business and, you know, basically return to, you know, I guess where they're performing well versus where they perform poorly.
It makes sense. Yeah. When you go through a tough time, you batten down the hatches and you go back to your knitting and, sounds like that's what they're doing. And, you know, it doesn't hurt that they have a smaller fund now to invest. They probably should focus on the core areas that they know best and deploy the capital they do in that area.
Yeah, I mean, they're DC people, you know, let them do infrastructure and telecom and, you know, all the boring stuff, you know, leave it to the LA and New York shops to
let Kim Kardashian do the consumer brand.
Yeah, exactly. Let Kim Kardashian pick the winners and losers of.
I think there was something in the news this week about Kim Kardashian's private equity firm. I think they got 8 people working for them now and they're closing in on their first deal or whatever it's going to be. I mean, I'm excited to see how that goes. I wonder if we'll look back and I wonder if she'll have her fund 7 and all of her carry checks and or if we'll look back and say, oh, that was a flash in the pan.
Well, all those companies that, you know, her fund buys, I mean, they basically have, you know, unlimited sales and marketing spend, right? I mean, Kim Kardashian
just
put up some product on her Instagram or TikTok. The whole family can, for that matter. So, you know, multiply that whatever by 10, and the whole world sees it, and it's probably an insane, you know, generator of sales for those companies.
And it's interesting because a lot of those consumer brands that you're talking about that are facing these headwinds, a lot of it's being replaced by sort of these more one-offy brands that aren't retail focused. They're direct consumer. They can be creator led or influencer led. And this is sort of, you know, Kim Kardashian doing it this at the highest level, right? Like she's going to go take an existing business, buy it. And, you know, I believe in the value add that she'll bring to a consumer type business. If I was one of those businesses and I was thinking about who was going to pay a higher price for me, Carlyle, the guys at Carlyle or Kim Kardashian, I would think Kim Kardashian is probably going to be the one who's going to turn around my business more than the team at Carlyle. Carlyle's trying to turn herself around.
Carlyle's a sponsor buyer and, you know, Kim Kardashian's a strategic buyer. Strategic buyers will always pay more, right? You've got synergies there that, you know, David Rubenstein is unfortunately not going to be able to offer with his social media presence.
I don't know. He's got a pretty good social media presence at this point. I don't know if you've seen some of his podcasting and interviews and stuff. It's actually pretty good.
That different audience.
I've watched it, different audience, and he does not pollute my Instagram feed to the extent
that I don't know if he wears Skims.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we move on. After years of bullying, Democratic regulators are paying the price. Because the PE industry is shifting its support from Democrats to Republicans for 2024 campaign dollars. So for the first time since 2016, now employees of PE firms are giving more money to Republicans than to Democrats.
The flippening, I think it hasn't been this flip, they were saying, since because it usually is reversed. Usually there's more Democrat donations. Except Mitt Romney in 2012 had 70% of the donations coming, the PE donations went 70% to Mitt Romney, which I'm sure is just a bunch of him donating to himself. I'm sure
it could be.
Mitt Bain donated a lot to his campaign and a lot of his friends in general donated. I mean, one thing you note from looking at these numbers is that, and you always just blown away by how small the numbers are when it comes to political donations sometimes that, you know, the top candidates have received, I think it was here I'm seeing is like President Biden has raised $317 from $1,000 from private equity so far. It's like minuscule amounts, right? And so far there's been $21 million raised total. Now the amounts end up $21 million total. And the amounts end up being, you know, at the end of the race, like in 2020, it was $200 million plus that people, that private equity spent on these races. So they do end up getting substantial, but here in the early days, especially, it's kind of crazy how small the numbers are compared to the trillions that we're often talking about on this program. We're talking about these asset classes.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see how this develops. You know, I imagine a lot of this, you know, will kind of come down to, you know, perhaps who the eventual Republican nominee is and, you know, down the ballot, who the nominees are. I mean, I think you saw strong Democratic support among, you know, from private equity or among private equity, you know, professionals. You know, it seemed like, you know, the more progressive or more, you know, liberal social, you know, policies tended to, you know, outweigh perhaps, you know, economic motivations historically. You know, even the sort of largest, you know, bank managers in the States, you know, the Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, et cetera, you know, run by, you know, what you might call kind of quote unquote, you know, moderate Democrats. It does seem though now that, you know, because there frankly been a lot of, you know, sort of Democrat led pushing against the industry, you know, from a tax perspective, from a regulatory perspective, that there does seem to have, you know, this flip does seem to have taken place where, you know, kind of the social concerns, you know, are less important compared to the real economic concerns here. So, you know, we'll see how this develops as well as sort of it becomes clear, you know, how both sides are kind of doing in the run up to the election.
Yeah, I think we have to see how it develops too, because obviously there's a lot more interest on the Republican side. There's a field to donate to where your dollars are going to make a big difference, where there's more interest in, you know, which firms really care about being the first one to donate to Biden's reelection campaign. I mean, it's not that pressing of a matter, but if you can put a little bit of money in the coffers of one of these hopefuls that you believe in or something like that on the Republican side, it probably attracts more. So, you know, by the end of this, we might see a more typical split where there's a slight leaning towards the Democrat side in terms of fundraising by the time we get into the actual election. So I don't know. I don't think it's too early to actually call it, but the, you know, storyline here is pretty, the narrative here is pretty solid. I mean, the Biden administration, you know, Gary Gensler and the SEC, Lina Khan and the FTC, they have, you know, been pretty aggressively going after certain parts of private equity. You know, we saw some of these reforms passed earlier this year that I think are not very aggressive, to be honest. But I do think that some of the things that the FTC has done, specifically this thing that just came out a couple weeks ago, where they're trying to get roll-ups to be declared, you know, a monopolistic practice, that is really, really economically damaging to the industry if that stuff goes through. So I think in general, I could see the narrative, although I don't know if the numbers are really going to play it out. Right now, they were saying only 56% of the donations have gone Republican. So it's barely a lean, you could say.
All right. Watch this space. Up next, a number of prominent billionaires, including Aliko Dangote and Carlos Rubenstein, have backed a sort of newish PE fund focused on Africa called Altera. Altera was spun out of Carlyle in mid-2020, and they have now closed, I think, their first round of financing, which is $140 million, and they are planning to invest that in Africa, of course, in telecommunications, technology, logistics, healthcare, consumer, and retail sectors. And of course, what's also interesting is that they're doing this while larger investors such as Carlyle, such as Blackstone, KKR, are really kind of pulling out of Africa.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting story also. I think there's a couple things to point out. You know, larger investors like Carlyle, you mentioned, Thomas, are pulling out, and Blackstone. It seems actually that, you know, the people filling that gap, I mean, obviously, this is basically a Carlyle fund that has been spun out. But the other funds that are filling the capital hole here are really just local. So, you know, at Carlyle, this is, you know, Altera is going to be a local capital. And, you know, perhaps that's going to make, you know, their investment thesis and track record, future track record, you know, a lot more successful. It may be hard, frankly, to invest from DC or New York or London if you don't really have an understanding of kind of the local ecosystem. So, you know, I think the continent overall, you know, faces a capital deficit, and, you know, there are a number of sort of lower hanging fruit with respect to infrastructure projects, telecom projects that do need funding. So if local, you know, locally based teams are the solution to that, you know, I think we'll see how Carlyle does with this fund and, you know, how receptive they are. I will note that, you know, the profile of the portfolio that Altera is looking to construct, they want at least, you know, half of the investments to be comprised of companies that are still generating the majority of their revenue in US dollars. So I think they are still hedging against, you know, the currency depreciation risk, you know, looking for hard currency denominated assets. So it's a bit more incremental than perhaps just a fund, you know, really entirely focused on the African continent. There's still some hedging going on with this new operation.
Literally hedging going on. Yeah, I find it interesting that the currency risk is some of the main risk that they face. I would have thought it was, you know, various political risks or, you know, execution risks and all this type of stuff. But that currency is a really, really big part of the type of risk that they're facing. And obviously, it gives you an idea about which way they think that direction the currency is going, that they are limiting, you know, this to 50% that can be local denominated versus they need 50% that's USD denominated. But yeah, I think it makes sense for them to spin out of Carlyle as well, for all the reasons that you mentioned, Adam, that it's makes sense to have more of a local team here. I think Africa is quite different and quite underdeveloped from a capital perspective and probably needs a customized touch to sort of work that investments in that continent versus other areas, which are much more developed and have, you know, talent where you could have a global firm kind of come in there. And in general, it also makes sense because, you know, we're seeing a lot of pullback from this sort of global standpoint in general, whether it be, you know, in Africa or other continents as well, and in Asia as well, that makes sense to kind of spin this off and do this locally. But it sounds like it's the same team roughly who's been doing this at Carlyle and maybe even be some of the same investments they've made here. It sounds like they've invested over $1 billion already into Africa. And that's, you know, basically there's just like last year, there was about $7 billion plus that was raised for investments in Africa. So another $500 million is, you know, going to go a long way, especially in a year like this year, where I'm sure it's quite difficult when treasuries are in the US are paying 5%, it's quite difficult to take a flyer to go invest in one of these markets that are more underdeveloped.
And look, it makes sense, you know, as if you have sort of a thesis, a geographic thesis. I mean, you know, you look at the world, the world is aging, right? And it's aging fastest in a lot of these economies in East Asia that were kind of the darlings of you know, foreign capital in the not so distant past. I mean, I feel like you could even just go back to 2020 or 2019 or 2020, and you know, it was still all about China, for example, and now the tune is very, very different. Africa is still the continent with, you know, relatively rapid population growth projected, you know, really an underpenetration of certain, you know, technologies, you know, mobile technology, digital technology. So, you know, this is kind of like the last, you know, less tapped, you know, major, you know, global market. And, you know, other than, you know, countries, you know, perhaps like the States that do take in large numbers of immigrants, you know, everyone else will frankly continue to age. Populations will shrink and, you know, growth will be much harder to sustain in those contexts. So, you know, it's probably wise to get rooted early on the African continent to take advantage of that.
Good stuff. Let's move on to our last story for today. This time we're talking about a shadow lending market in the U.S. that is being funded by insurance premiums, according to the New York Times. Basically, here's what's going on. In a trend that was kind of started by Apollo, PE firms have been acquiring stakes in insurance companies or portfolios of annuities from insurance companies, and then they use the premiums debt to collect to expand their businesses, particularly including lending. And basically the premiums act as a continuous source of funding, which, you know, is of course in contrast to the traditional way of getting funds, which is, you know, regularly going out and having to sort of do discrete fundraisers every year, or every couple of years rather, from pensions and endowments.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it before. Warren Buffett invented this. He invented private equity, and this is the most patient capital there is these people who pay in their annuities every month and every year. These guys are out there buying float. So, and the key that they're talking about here, though, is about how they're managing that float. So they go and they buy a float that's managed somewhat conservatively by an insurance company. And the idea is, and what these studies have shown and all this stuff, is that when they go and they buy this float that's conservatively managed, what they do is they, in order to make more off of it, they will kind of up-risk it. They will, you know, invest it into private credit, into private equity, and sort of manage the portfolio in a more risky fashion, which, to be honest, is sorely needed. If you look at some of these companies, insurance companies, they are very much underwater on these annuities that they wrote, let's say, years and years ago, when the equity returns were considered to be high, and now they're considered to be low, et cetera, et cetera. They are generally, or specifically not equity returns, the fixed income returns actually were much higher before. And this last spate of a decade or so, where we had no interest rates, they basically were very much behind or in the hole. And so they need to manage more aggressively. This article is kind of saying, are they managing it too aggressively? I don't think more aggressive is always a bad thing. I mean, it's something to watch out for. But that's kind of what they're talking about going on here.
Yeah, this kind of fits into the first story, or one of the first.
We're coming full circle.
Right. I mean, you know, I was just reading this. I'm surprised to see, maybe I shouldn't be, that half of Apollo's business is actually, you know, the insurer Athene.
I was seeing that one fifth of overall business for these large guys, about 20% of their commitments come from insurance, which, by the way, it's very different when an insurance company invests in private equity than when the private equity firm buys float. It's a very different setup about regulatorily and what is exactly going on, because obviously the insurance company is the one managing the float when they invest into a private equity firm. But when a private equity firm buys the float, now they're the ones managing the float, and they have maybe an incentive to be more aggressive with it. And there can even be some internal, or there even is, certainly with Athene and Apollo, for instance, a lot of internal dealing where you're kind of just funneling that float into your own fee-earning vehicles.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, these institutions, these alternative asset managers, as they've all, you know, been rebranding themselves as, you know, they're now insurers, you know, they're lenders, they're the bank, you know, they're owners and operators of businesses, you know, they have wealth management units. I mean, they really are kind of turning into these one-stop shop, you know, financial institutions. So, anyway, I'm actually surprised, you know, the direct lending news and the insurance news in private equity actually has not been linked. They seem to be pretty much following the same logic of, you know, consolidation and, you know, the potential systemic risk being posed here by these large alternative asset managers that, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, you know, only did kind of buyouts of, you know, struggling companies and, you know, and turned those businesses around. So these are very, very different sort of animals to the, you know, their previous iterations.
And let's remember, these insurance companies are legitimately systemically important, right? AIG was bailed out. These companies do affect everyday people's retirements, et cetera, et cetera. And so if, to the kind of the point from the beginning of the episode that Adam was talking about, is that if one can bring down the other, if Apollo brings down Athene, for instance, even if Apollo, the private equity firm, the big bad guys that the Democrat administration is after, even if those guys go down, and that'll be fine, if they take down Athene with them, they will be systemically important.
Yeah, look, I mean, it wasn't AIG, you know, that took down AIG. It was their, you know, small, you know, I think they call the AIG FP or AIG Financial Products, based in Greenwich, that, you know, wrote all of the insurance, the swap insurance, and that's what ultimately took down, a really, large and, historically rich American business, sort of without folks really, I'm sure, at the main company even noticing. One corner of your business can certainly take down the rest, and that's been proven.
Excellent. A word of caution there. Very good. Let's wrap it up here. It's been another great episode, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.